One of the great things that Lucas did as CEO was the decision to make us profitable. It was a really hard decision, and we had to actually let go of 5 people at the time to just be profitable overnight. But that changed the business in so many ways. We started to look way further down the road and start to think about what we could do, because there was no issue of runway or being able to, you know, stand on our own 2 feet. I think that started getting the wheels turning with Lucas and Lee around what was this business and what could this business become.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, you might also like my personal newsletter. Each week, I share a lesson, a question, or an idea that I've picked up while learning from others. Subscribe at adaminseattle.com. On this episode, I met with Peter Hamilton. He was the CEO at Tune, where he led the business to $80 million of ARR and grew the team to over 350 people in the last 7 years. Tune had 2 major product lines that led to 2 separate acquisitions, the first in 2018 and the second in 2020. We talked about Peter's transition from CMO to CEO, how they decided to build a profitable business, how Peter thinks about brand and customer service, and some of the parallels between his past in opera singing and company building. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with the one, the only, Peter Hamilton. Hey, Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Why, thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to be talking with you. It's been a little while.
It has. You look the same. I feel like we haven't aged a day.
We look exactly the same. Yeah, I think we've probably known each other. Oh, has it been a decade? I don't want to sound too old here, man.
It has, for sure. Now we count the years and decades.
I was just looking at your LinkedIn profile, and I noticed a couple of things. It said you'd raised $36 million, grew to $75 million of ARR, 350 people. But it didn't say anything about how many people you served gourmet lunch to during the course of the journey at Tune.
That's a good question. We did have a somewhat infamous chef program that was started actually at employee 40 is when we brought on the chef. But our goal was just to make sure we were spending time together and eating together during the day, and not just eating fast food that was around us and all that sort of thing. So we always, from the beginning, it was super shoestring budget, but we just found a visionary, found an awesome chef in Chris Blanco. And he was just relentlessly resourceful, as you should be in a startup, any startup. So he just made amazing meals on a very low budget. And then over time, we grew it as a program along with the company. So yeah, it was about 200 people all in Seattle that were being fed lunch every day. And it was awesome. It was just such a inspiring thing to have grow along with our startup.
Were you and the founders into food, or like, was there, what kind of drove the decision to do that?
Well, really, it was Lee's idea, one of the co-founders. So the co-founders are twin brothers, Lucas and Lee Brown. And Lee was notorious for what sort of out of the box crazy thing can we think up, and how can we do it without costing a lot of money? And so he really instigated it. And yeah, he and Lucas would go to Subway every single day in early startup days. I literally remember them going like Monday through Friday, like every day to Subway together.
Wow.
And yeah, you know, they loved the, especially Lee loved the ideas, man, if we could just have meals that were like here and that were warm and that were good, and who knows what it could turn into. And yeah, that vision definitely panned out.
That's incredible. So they really upped their lunch game from Subway once you brought that chef on board.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah, it was so much fun. And so many other great cooks and chefs came through that program. People that have started their own restaurants since then, people that have become head cooks at other places, and people have gone on to get into the startup and tech world as well. So it's been fun to watch everybody flourish through it.
Wow, what an incredible thing to happen from that seed you guys planted when it was just 40 people. I didn't realize you did it when it was so early on, because I remember talking to you about it. Maybe you had a couple hundred people, and it was, the program was already like at pretty good scale for serving that kind of lunch.
So. And we were bootstrapped, if you'll recall, you know. Yeah. So this was not some sort of VC funded exercise. This was coming off of trying to be profitable and figure out how to grow the business and also do things like this that would bring us together as a team.
Yeah. I want to talk about that a little bit more because people have probably read headlines about your recent acquisition and maybe going back to your big rounds of funding with Accel and others. What was it like in those early days when you came on and the business was bootstrapped? I know Lucas and Lee had started this and then you came in. What did the company look like at that point?
It was pretty unique. Lucas and Lee had done well in the ad tech world, had their own advertising network, and had enough cash to be able to bootstrap something like this. They, you know, really had a belief that SaaS had a place in performance marketing. And when I came in and met them in the beginning, I actually met them over Craigslist, by the way, which is a fun story. And Cameron Stewart, who was working with them at the time, brought me in. I was already a big fanboy of Salesforce and what had happened in the SaaS world and how SaaS businesses were changing all these categories. And I was really familiar with performance marketing. So there was just a great sort of fit and understanding about, hey, this is going to apply to this industry as well. And they had built some things in a previous company as well that helped, you know, give them a foundation for what technology could look like. And really decided to kick it off and get an MVP out there within a matter of months. We had, in the very first launch, we got all the bloggers and everybody that was in the ad tech and affiliate marketing type world to write about it and do reviews and all that kind of stuff. And we literally had several thousand people sign up for the product over that first summer, and which wow. is virtually unheard of. So that then we had to figure out how to charge money for it and turn it into a business.
You got to tell the story of Craigslist. You met your business partners through Craigslist. Say more about that.
Hey, this was a time when, you know, Craigslist jobs were a little more legitimate, maybe.
What year was this?
This was 2008.
Okay, we're going to do some online research and see if they really were legitimate in 2000.
Yeah, I would say fringe. It was on the fringe. But I had gotten into digital marketing through SEO and PPC and some into the performance marketing side. I worked for a little boutique agency. During that time, I had also started a couple of other random entrepreneurial ventures. I had a little e-commerce store and I had a brick and mortar franchise business that I had bought into and started building up. But I was always looking for, you know, what's going on in Seattle when it comes to digital marketing, performance marketing, and who knows what's going to be next. And they had posted an ad on Craigslist for someone to help them with their advertising network to do SEO and pay-per-click marketing and grow inbound lead funnel for the B2B part of that business. And so that's what I answered to, just to see, yeah, maybe this is another thing I can help out with and learn some things along the way. And yeah, so when I responded to that ad, Cameron Stewart, who is now the GM of Tune at Constellation, who was formerly the COO when I was the CEO, was the one who answered that email and brought me in for that first meeting.
Wow, that's a great backstory. I had no idea. And so this is, it's still called Has Offers at that point. It's very right. early days.
That's right.
Tell me about how did you go from that to becoming the CEO of the business to responding to this Craigslist ad for kind of a vague, sounds like a marketing job.
That's right. I eventually became, you know, the CMO, the go-to-market person for the product. And so that was really my job, establishing our online presence and also our business development presence in the ecosystem. Cameron eventually took on a sales position and began to run and had our first early sales team as well. And so that was through 2009 and into 2010. One of the last just great things that Lucas did as CEO was the decision to make us profitable. It was a really hard decision, and we had to actually let go of 5 people at the time to just be profitable overnight. But that changed the business in so many ways. We started to look way further down the road and start to think about what we could do because there was no issue of runway or being able to, you know, stand on our own 2 feet. And I think that started getting the wheels turning with Lucas and Lee around what was this business and what could this business become. And they started to think about, you know, what leadership would look like and teams and all that sort of thing. And I was certainly eager to take on anything I could in an early startup. That's really how this came about, is I started to take on responsibilities that a CEO would do. And I started to collaborate on those things with Lucas. And over time, it became clear that it might make more sense for me to focus on those things and for Lucas to focus more on the product. And it was actually Lucas and Lee that took me to Picado Bueno, Mexican food place out on the patio there, and sat me down and said that it was their desire for me to become the CEO. And I was astounded. I was super excited. And it was an incredible amount of faith they put in me, and I'm appreciative of it to this day.
How incredible that they initiated that. That has to be so rare.
They fully did. At that point, we didn't have investors or anyone trying to throw their right around about how leadership should look or work or function. And so it really was their own introspection that brought them to that conclusion. And I really, you know, respect that. It's hard for startup founders to recognize that.
Being bootstrapped and profitable and making that decision early on, how did that drive the culture and who was attracted to the business and how the team took shape in those early days?
We were just a bunch of really scrappy people that were just trying to build what we believed was right, tried to listen to our customer as much as possible. I will say Lucas and Lee had a lot of visibility into what was happening in the industry and ecosystem. So they were able to act somewhat as oracle to what they believed the customer wanted, even though we didn't always hear that from the customer. And so that was a very unique situation. We also had the competition from years gone by to look at and say, what do people hate about that? Let's not be that. And yeah, we were hiring engineers, certainly that were mid-level or sometimes earlier in their careers, and learning on the job and trying to figure out how to make ends meet every month and just push. I think it was a very scrappy culture of people that wanted to see us get over the goal line.
Did people, when you were interviewing and hiring in those days, were they confused? Were they like, wait, what was your Series A? What was your Series B? Because you guys ran a long way without taking in a dollar. So what were the conversations like when you were out recruiting and building the team?
They absolutely were a little confused by who we were. And as a result, we didn't hire a lot of people that were your typical Series A pedigree startup people. We hired people from other companies and industries, oftentimes that were not VC-backed types of companies. And it was definitely different and made it difficult for us to hire folks that were used to that mindset. And so what's your runway? And we're like, I don't know what that means. We're trying to be profitable and keep going forever as long as we can. So some of those artifacts just weren't there. But yeah, there were some people that were really impressed by it and got excited by it too. And especially for some of the more senior talent, we were always looking to Amazon and places like that, but maybe they had gotten tired of the status quo and big company and wanted to try something else out that was, you know, smaller company and wanted to do it for more of a lifestyle choice. That would be true for the history of Toon, that we were looking for people that would really enjoy their work every day more so than what is the, you know, short-term stock outcome.
When you did make the decision to flip the model over to the VC model and you ended up raising, you know, quite a bit of capital, was there tension in that decision, or how did that decision unfold inside the leadership team or inside the company more broadly?
The main instigator of that was a new business that we had launched inside of our company. So we bootstrapped Has Offers to profitability, and this was a SaaS platform for managing affiliate partnerships. And we realized through that business and through some of our customers there that there was not a very effective way to measure the app downloads that came from your advertising spend. It was early days in the app stores in general. And customers like Zynga were trying to figure out how to connect the dots between an advertisement and a consumer actually downloading an app. And Kabam Games was also a big one in those early days trying to solve this problem. And we created a product called mobileapptracking.com and launched it to market. And we got a lot of just amazing feedback right off the bat. We were talking to Fortune 500 type businesses, and we were, so we believed that this business had legs and that it was likely going to be a large business. At the same time, we were basically funding it off of whatever profits that we could develop off of Has Offers. And that made it very difficult to let it run and really invest into it properly. So we decided that we had two businesses inside of our company. We had this profitable cash cow type of a company that was growing, but not double, triple digit percentage growth pattern. And then we had this very VC-backed looking startup that needed fuel in order to meet the market demand. And timing for that market demand was also very much an issue. There was whoever was going to be first in measuring these mobile app downloads was certainly going to be a critical player for many years to come. So we decided to look for a partner, look for a financial partner.
The whole history is so unique there. What gave you the confidence from Has Offers to invest in that whole new business? Because you don't see that too often where some bootstrap company spins up a whole nother unit and then that unit becomes bigger and higher growth than the original company. Usually they stick to, hey, we've got this lifestyle business. We're going to throw off cash. We're not going to like go take a swing at this other pitch over here. How did that come to be?
I really have to blame the insanity of founders for that coming to fruition. Certainly, Lucas was heading product and focusing on how to take advantage of this moment in time where there was not an effective way to measure these things. And started to talk to customers and build up that dialogue and get other people excited about it. And honestly, Lucas and Lee were able to, with the help of a couple of others, just get something out the door, get an MVP out that was very low cost. And so once we were able to test it and see, is there market demand? Is this going to go somewhere? Then we knew whether or not this was worth investing into. So we had the chance to do it. We did have enough profits to be able to get to that MVP. And the first year actually was not as easy as we sometimes remember it. We like to look back and think, oh, we launched this thing. It was off to the races and it just grew like a weed and it was so fast. And really the first year was slow. It was a lot of conversations with all these customers and figuring out exactly what they really did need and what they really did want and what would work with their platforms and across platforms. And working with all of their partners was a big issue. I remember there was a time when we walked into Tapjoy's office because one of our customers wanted to be able to measure app downloads from Tapjoy. And we said, basically, we need the customer to install our SDK, and then we can send the data to you as well so you can see your performance. And they were like, why in the world would we ever let our customer install your SDK? That's never going to happen. And so we were laughed out of that office. And it took another 6 months to start to see more and more partners buy on to this idea of a third party measuring it. And over that time, too, there was a big change that happened in the app stores, which was in-app purchases started to climb. And suddenly there was a way to drive revenue through these mobile apps that was much more clear, especially in free-to-play games. And that meant that user acquisition ROI started to have a real economy that was building up around it. So we were there to be able to measure that ROI and that connection to advertising and what is your cost per install and what revenue is generated from that install. And that's once that really started to take hold, then we started to see rapid growth and many more customers follow in the footsteps of a game like Kingdoms of Camelot that ended up being the top grossing app in the App Store in 2012 because they were using our software to measure 70 different partners and what was coming from all of those marketing partners. And the next year, 2013, was when we started to see many customers follow suit. And when we decided we needed fuel to see this thing through.
That's interesting that it took a year before those forces really converged. What did it feel like then when everything did start to line up, all those big external trends plus your own kind of bottom-up process? Did you say, oh, we have product market fit? What was the feeling inside the company as that started to come together?
I would say, so Micah Gantman was really running sales and business development for that product at the time. And you could just see him working into a frenzy. It was just a barrage of conversations on this logo, all coming in through the door. So certainly we realized this is something that everyone needs and wants, and we have to be positioned to be able to provide it and provide it quickly. That said, we knew we needed to do a lot to the product to make it easy for people to onboard and make it more usable for lots of different kinds of companies and different market segments and that sort of thing. And we also needed to make sure that we could scale up customer service along with it. We had learned a lot about customer service from HasOffers. It was incredible to be able to build on the backs of principles we'd already established within our company about how quickly we respond to people, how we solve their problems, how technical our customer support is and our account management. And so we were able to build onto that, but we knew we needed more bodies. We needed more people to be able to service that as well. So yeah, it started to, the demand started to outpace our ability to deliver.
What were some of the key principles that you learned in there about customer success that you were able to take from the operating history of HasOffers and apply forward?
Well, in the early days, we all pitched in to customer service. You know, myself and Cameron, especially Lucas, he was notorious. He had an alias called Ben as a customer service rep. So if you got Ben, you actually were talking to the founder and he was fixing all your stuff. But there was a belief that customer service for a company like this should be able to solve problems and be able to be technical and walk you through something and be very responsive. And there was no reason to, you know, withhold that kind of support and information. And we just believed if people were able to solve their problems quickly, that they would have success. And so we built a lot around response times, customer satisfaction surveys, early NPS, all these things that helped us determine if people were having a great experience through customer service. Steve Burgess actually came on board, who was an amazing influence on us because he had run customer service teams, much larger teams at Microsoft and other places. And he also understands that customer service it's a labor of love. You've got to have people that are passionate about getting to the heart of problems and making things right for your customers. And I would say many years from then, we would point back to that as, you know, part of our brand as a company, when what people came to expect when they interacted with Tune and Tune employees.
Why do you think so many startups miss the boat on that? Like, they don't get that principle, or they don't set up their customer support in a way that, or service, however you want to call it, in a way that solves problems and just gets people where they need to go quickly, as you're describing?
Obviously, it depends on industry and what your product does and how technical it is. We knew that our product was technical. We knew that that represented some of our major hurdles. If people couldn't use our software, couldn't run campaigns, they would not stay on, it would not grow, it would not go anywhere. And I think that many startups, you know, don't necessarily have that same requirement from a technical perspective. And so it gets glossed over a bit. When I do talk to startups in the B2B world, I ask them about what they're doing in customer service and how that interaction looks and how they're measuring the effectiveness of it. And it's usually somewhat of a blank response. And and I think it's just they don't feel the same pain and necessity. But I do recommend to people like that, spend the time figuring out what is going to be the passion and drive of the individuals that are going to be a part of that organization, so that it starts to scale on its own and it starts to build a real experience of your brand, because it's one of the number one ways that people talk to you. And if they don't have a good experience when they talk to you in that way, your brand is going to suffer as a result.
Talk to me, just changing gears a little bit here. Tell me the story behind the acquisition. So I know Constellation because I always read the annual letters, incredible annual letters they have out of there. But how did you get connected with them, and what was the genesis of selling Tune to Constellation Software?
I do have to back up because we had two acquisitions at Toon, which is somewhat uncommon. We sold our mobile attribution business in 2018 to Branch, and then we sold our partner platform to Constellation here this year. And that was, having two businesses inside of one always made it complicated when talking about the eventual outcome. What company is going to buy both of these businesses, as an example? And it became more and more apparent as the years went on that VC-backed fast growth startup I talked about earlier would likely have a more strategic buyer, and that the moderate growing, more cash flow positive business that was has offers would likely become a part of a more financial organization's strategy. And that's actually how it played out in the end. You never know what's going to happen. And I always say, I certainly have employees from other startups that I'll run across and they'll say, hey, I know you're friends with my CEO. So what are we going to do? Are we going IPO or are we going to sell the company? What's going to happen? And I'm like, first of all, I certainly don't know, but I bet your CEO doesn't either because that's just not how it works. You certainly plan for every eventual outcome and you build relationships and all the different pathways that might be possible and think about, you know, how those pathways are going to progress over time. But even in 2017, I could not have told you that we were going to sell these two businesses separately in two different acquisitions. And yeah, so this past one, certainly closing a deal in a pandemic has its challenges, as you would imagine. We signed our LOI back at the end of January, and it took some time dealing with diligence in a pandemic to make sure that we were all going to get through this and on to the next thing. And I have to say, I'm very grateful to the folks at Constellation that they continue to believe in the industrial logic of this acquisition and believed in the future of this digital marketing group that's now established over there. People describe Constellation, I'm not giving any trade secrets away, by saying they describe them as the Berkshire Hathaway of software. And it really is true that they buy and hold companies forever. And of the many hundreds of acquisitions they've made, they've only divested two of them, you know, that I'm aware of. And they believe that the companies they bring on board need to have a 10-year forecast and have a long future ahead of them. And so it actually made a lot of sense for this business that was the partner platform, originally called HasOffers. Bear with me on all the names here. It made sense that that business, which was the first one we launched, which was profitable for the majority of its life and was always stable and growing, would be attractive to that kind of a buyer that sees that kind of future in our category. And it just so happened they had acquired one of our larger competitors a year before. So they certainly have built a thesis around this category and are, you would imagine, building a strategy to take it over.
So good for people who are building other digital marketing companies to be aware of, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. This digital marketing group, if you talk to them today, they plan to be very acquisitive in the coming years. And so I highly recommend getting to know them.
Awesome. Now the big question I have for you is, what's next? I know you're doing a bunch of advising. Are we going to see you start another company or go to the investing side? What's next for you?
I don't really know the answer to that question. I am having a blast working with startups, and especially early stage. There are so many fun things that you get to tackle that I've had even forgotten about. So I'm just having a blast, you know, working with startups and being helpful where I can. If I'm advising, I always say, don't give me equity off the bat. Let's see if I'm actually helpful. And then if you decide you don't want me to go away, then we could talk about something more formal. I've done some angel investment, which has also been really fun. And mostly in things that are not ad tech, martech related. But I have taken on a couple of board seats that are more martech oriented. And so that feels like I get to apply some of my Rolodex and some of my strategic knowledge in that field to those companies right now. And yeah, I don't know. I don't really see going straight to early stage right away. Now talk to me in a year and maybe my mind will change about that. But I like the idea of partnering with or operating with a company that is ready to take it from, say, the 25 to 75 million, and which I got to do once. I'd like to do it again. And then I'd like to do the next stage, 75 plus, and get up into the, you know, the quarter billion types of digits in revenue and see what that is like and have that experience.
I'm excited to see where it goes. I'm curious too, as you've been doing advising, mentoring, investing, are there common themes that you've come across where you're able to take things that you experienced and go deep with people on and help them? And I'm curious, like the questions you're asking or maybe the patterns that you're starting to see as you've zoomed out and helping a wider range of companies.
There are. I think where I'm helping a lot of people is in their storytelling. What is their vision? What is their mission? How does that relate to the timing of everything that's happening right now in the world? And what does that mean in terms of a market opportunity? And just getting some clarity around that. That's something I've gotten good at over the years, created lots and lots of decks, and it's something that I enjoy. It's really fun. Storytelling is one of my favorite things to do. When it comes to SaaS businesses, building a SaaS brand is something I get inspired about. I think it's probably one of the best things that we did at Tune. Created something where our customers and our partners really felt a part of our story and felt like they were helping to change the ecosystem with us all together. And that was so powerful in our business, even when the winds of change were negative for us. You know, we had a problem with Facebook where Facebook kicked us out of their partner program. And the year following that, we grew 100% in revenue, which is just insane. And it's because it's because of the brand that we had built and that customers felt connected and aligned with our story and wanted to be a part of it.
Where do you start in the conversation about brand with a founder or a company that you're working with?
Maybe they know the answer to this question already, and maybe not. And if not, they need to go find it. The question is, what do your customers say your brand is? Your brand is not what you say you are, but it's what they say you are. It has to be words that come from their mouth. And so if you don't know what that is now, then how are you going to impact changing it? How are you going to take it in the direction that you want it to go in? So it's figuring out what's the baseline. Who are you today? And what would people say about you today? And then let's talk about what do we want people to say about us in the future? And finally, we can create a roadmap on how to get from A to B.
That's such a great framing question, right? Because it's so true. It's not what you want it to be necessarily, but what the world says about you.
Something in a little bit different category when it comes to the culture and team and management that I don't think we did a great job of in the beginning, but I talk about it often with startups now, is framing your startup as a team and not a family. And it's not a new concept. There's actually an article that Reid Hoffman put out about this, that, you know, your startup is a team, not a family. And it is such a fantastic analogy, because it works in just about every kind of scenario. When you think about what decisions should we make about our culture or about what we're going to do with this employee or with this performance issue or whatever that might be, that are we becoming a great team, a high performance team? And what are we going to do to make sure that happens? If we were a family, we would never fire anyone, because you can't fire your brother or your sister or your cousin. That's something that's hardwired in. You've got to deal with each other no matter what. And we were very much a family in early days, which made parting ways with someone just excruciating. It made it very, very painful. It hurt our hearts because we established ourselves as a family. But if you start at the onset thinking about yourself as a high performance team, like a group of athletes, as an example, you all are trying to make each other better. You're also trying to hold each other accountable to make sure that they're there to catch the ball and that you are going to, you know, accomplish everything that you set out to. And you're not going to feel as emotional about the decisions that do need to happen to make sure the team wins. And in fact, you'll feel only better about those decisions, that this is something that we're doing to win. And that's why we're doing it. And that is okay, because that is, you know, what a startup is and what a business is.
Was that a framework that you identified in the journey at Tune, that you said, hey, we have to make this mental shift and thinking of as a family to thinking about as a team?
Absolutely. It was a transition for us. And I wish that we had thought about it that way early on. That was a foreign concept to us in a lot of ways. I look back on the years and I think, man, so many amazing, special, wonderful things happened because we were like a family. And these people are going to be some of my, they're my tribe. They are going to be my family for many years to come. But I also see a lot of hurt and a lot of difficulty that happened along the way as a result as well. And I think setting that expectation up front and just saying, look, this is what we're here to do and we're here to win, just really helps everyone focus on what is important and focus on winning. And that's what startups need, is they need focus. And I would say, yeah, it was, I would say post Series B that we started.
Wow, it's late. Yeah. Yeah. Incredible. Yeah. But now you're able to, when you come into a company advising, you can see the signs of, oh, you guys are a family. Like, we go to have the family team conversation now.
Yeah. And it's not like, I don't want to kill your family or anything.
Right. No, I'm thinking of like Last Dance or, I don't know if you watched the Blackpink documentary, the K-pop group, like, yeah, I don't know. I kind of have that analogy sitting in my head.
That's totally right. For me, I don't know if I mentioned this earlier. I used to be an opera singer. And so music and performance was what I grew up doing and also what I thought I would do for a long time into the future. And it taught me about being able to focus on the output we're trying to create above everything else and working together alongside many other musicians to make that happen, but making sure that we kept our focus together. And if we did, we would just do outstanding things, beyond human types of things. It also thickened our skin up a little bit because we knew the person that was saying, you held that for an eighth long and was getting onto us or for whatever reason, hey, it's supposed to be pianissimo or whatever the issue was, we knew that they were just trying to win. We knew they just wanted it to be great. And so we all are sitting there as musicians trying to create something that is a musical moment, something that's worth being on this earth for and be around. And the same thing can happen in startups and should.
I love that. I wouldn't have thought that you'd have principles from opera singing apply so well into company building, but it sounds like it really did.
Yeah, for better or worse, yeah.
All right, Peter, I want to wrap up with the Supersonic Six.
All right.
Number one, how much coffee do you drink?
5 cups a day on average.
Woo! All right.
I get it started early. I was down when we were all still in offices and things, I was down till 2 or 3. But being at home, man, ooh, and as the
too easy to drink it.
Got this cup right
oh,
next
oh, there
to
you go. Cup. Yeah. Number two, what's one Seattle company that you're following or studying right now?
I can't just say one, but I'll give maybe two that are really different from each other. One that's just exciting to me because what I talked about earlier in this world of media and intellectual property and streaming and all of that is Scener, an advisor over there. They are just going through radical growth. And it's a phenomenon. We don't have a lot of phenomenon type companies in Seattle. So I'm really interested to see where that goes and how it plays in the broader platform space. There's so many eventualities that could come from it. The other is actually one that has been around for a long time and has been just experiencing explosive growth in the last couple of years. And it's Tatango. I'm sure you're familiar with them.
Oh yeah.
Been around doing text message marketing for a decade. And in these last couple of years, it has become a thing. Text message marketing is officially here. You've seen others in the category raise large sums of money, Attentive raising $230 million. So there's certainly an opportunity to be, you know, a category leader and certainly a very large business. And it's a business that was not totally unlike things like an ESP business or a marketing automation business, but it's taking into account a new channel that is really becoming very popular. So yeah, I'm excited to see where that goes.
Number three, who's one Seattle person that you're following or learning from right now?
Well, I thought about this for a second. I think Mike Sievert at T-Mobile is someone I'm incredibly impressed with. I also relate to him a little bit, that he came from really being the CMO over there and moving into this leadership position now. He's, you know, at the wheel of a company that gets to be a carrier and a platform, and he's exploring that to the fullest. Before moving into this most, you know, recent role, the Un-carrier strategy and branding and go to market was really from him, and it is one of the most memorable advertising campaigns of the last decade. And so I just see him as a really inventive person that is now in control of a large organization that needs to figure out what their long-term place is going to be and how they're going to interact with other platforms, you know, like Google and Apple. And I think they've got a lot to develop ahead of them. They have their own dongle, their own streaming now, all these things. They're getting to play in almost every category that I think is interesting. So he's someone I follow a lot. And then on the, with the advising and early stage stuff, I got to toss out Kirby Winfield's name. It's been really fun to watch him develop as a leader in this community of angels and of early stage funds. And I just really appreciate his attitude. He's one of those people, if you get to work with him as a startup, he's going to shoot you straight. He's not going to make up some excuse about why he's not investing. He'll probably just tell you that he's just not that into it. And that's okay too. He's just a really honorable person that tries to do the right thing and pay it forward to startups.
Love those. Yeah, T-Mobile kind of gets overlooked sometimes, but what a great place to look for inspiration. And Kirby, for the listeners, Kirby was on this podcast not too long ago. I can't remember the episode number, but go back to the archives and listen to Kirby, because he is incredibly open about his whole story and really fun guy to learn
from. It'll probably be way more fun than this one. Definitely go check out
Kirby. No way. Finish listening to this one first. Number four, what's the one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
Well, there are several folks I think that agree to this, that the super angel, the large angel check sizes are missing in our ecosystem. There's plenty of people that are going to write you a 25K check or maybe a 50K check, but finding folks that'll come in for 300, 350 is a lot more difficult. And as a result, you really have smaller funds that are needing to stand in the gap there. The problem is, like, funds that have LPs, they have just more scrutiny. Like, it's more difficult for them to get a deal done. They've got more people involved. And early stage, when it comes to a fund versus early stage to a super angel, is totally different. They have more that they've got to prove. So I would love to see more super angels coming out of the woodwork, people to fill in that gap. So we've got a gap there, which is very noticeable. And then we also, honestly, I still believe have a gap in the Series A level. Once you've gone past the full larger seed round stage and you're ready to raise $10+ million, there's still a need to go down to the valley and find competition there. So obviously there, I see new funds opening and starting all the time, but we don't have a lot that will really write the large checks. So those are two areas I think that we'll need to grow if we want to have an ecosystem that rivals the valley.
Number five, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self?
Ooh, a lot of people ask me, like, how did I move from music into technology? And when I was in college, I really wanted to drop out of college. I wanted to drop out of college. I want to go to New York, and I just wanted to pursue music. And I was getting a music degree at the time. And I got into the degree path just because it was an area of interest. And no one really talked to me about what's the business of music. What is that going to be like? You know, what is it like to be constantly on the road and auditioning? What is it like to be a part of a union? All of the P's and Q's. And I would go back and tell my earlier self that you're not going to enjoy the business part of it. And that you do enjoy business. And that you just need to find the kind of business that inspires you and that you get excited about participating in. So I'm not sure I would listen to myself, but that's certainly, that's what I would tell them.
Number six, what can this community do to help you? Do you have a cause, a thing, a CTA, anything you want people to go do, as my kids are screaming in the background?
I would just say I'm here to help people right now. I'm in a phase in life where I have the opportunity and the time and the means to be here, be a listening ear. I know that founders struggle with all kinds of things. CEOs struggle with all kinds of things. So connect me to people that want someone to talk to. I'm happy to chat. There's always time on the schedule and the calendar somewhere. So just think of me when you've got somebody that needs to, especially if they're trying to put together their story and figure out what the next step is for their startup, or maybe they just need to talk about something that's really hard or difficult that they're going through right now. I would love those kinds of connections. If folks are going through like seed raise and Series A, that's also a place where I love to hop in and help wherever I can. And I'd love to chat.
Great. Where should people find you?
LinkedIn. I'm actually really good at LinkedIn. Some people are not.
You respond. That's good. You figured out how to work with their little messaging system.
That's right. No, LinkedIn is great. And I'll just give you my email address through there and we can connect further. Yeah, I'm always on and happy to respond.
Thanks so much for taking the time today, Peter. I loved going back through some of your story, and thanks for sharing.
Absolutely.
Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.